Thank you for inviting me. I particularly want to thank Raymond for making sure I had exercise before my talk in the afternoon. And when I was arranging this visit, I was asking both of the possibilities of running and swimming. And the thanks to Raymond, I do both at the same time. So I will talk about the origin of probability in quantum mechanics. The subject is, of course, close to 8 years old. This key paper appeared 79 years ago, proposing this formula. It's known as Born's rule, but I think no one refers to it by this name. I think everybody takes it for granted. And as part of quantum mechanics, when in fact, if you look at textbooks, you will have it listed somewhere as one of the axioms. So if you go through the axioms, you may have a list something like this. The universe consists of systems, pure state is a vector, in the Hilbert space, composite pure state is a vector, etc. Evolutions of isolated systems are unitary, observables are associated with Hermitian operators. So far, so good. All of that stuff really poses no problems, and in fact, poses no interpretation problems, and this is because up to here it was very hard to find a connection between this stuff and the real world. Now, the connections between this stuff and the real world start here. So here's one. The only possible outcome of measurement is an eigenstate and the corresponding eigenvalue of such an Hermitian operator. That's a famous collapse. And then, as a crowning axiom in some sense, a connection that allows us to develop the relation between all of this stuff and what people do in the laboratories. And that's probabilities of various outcomes are given by Born's rule. Now, as I said, the ones in black are uncontroversial and there is no problem. I would claim the one with blue in blue can be explained by decoherence and environment-induced superselection. I will explain this abbreviation in more detail, but that's what fine selection really stands for. But this means that you are really relying on the last axiom. Because whenever you are doing decoherence, you are using reduced density matrices, and the physical interpretation of reduced density matrices is based on Born's rule. Now, we would like to derive this one without circularity. So that's the A. By the way, I should tell you, I welcome questions during the talk, and I reserve the right to suppress them. Peace.
I'm sorry to put this off, but the very first axiom looks to me controversial.
I agree, right? I'm quoting. I'm not formulating with you. I absolutely agree. Right? In fact, I think this is the big next unsolved problem. Okay? And I put it in writing, so I can absolutely. I would reformulate it, right? It's not the universe consistent system is controversial. It's what the heck is a system.
Yes.
So, yes.
So is the problem then that the universe itself is an isolated system, I guess, and then it's unitary, and then you lose the unitarity when you get into Born's rule?
You lose unitarity somewhere here, right? But I mean, this loss of unitarity you can, with the help of Everett, explain without, as sort of your way of viewing from your branch of the rest of the universe. Right? But when Everett put out that thing, he said, look, and the biggest result that I can derive from this approach is Born's rule. Now, it turned out he couldn't. And then there were several attempts, Bryce DeWitt, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. they all relied on Everett light approaches and on frequency approaches, and all of them failed. I should say, because I'm going to be called to task if I don't, that there is a derivation which predates Everett's approach of Bonjour. But it's very much within the framework of Copenhagen interpretation. And you know, there are some important representatives in the audience of this sort of an approach, of the extension of this sort of approach. But I mean, this interpretation, in some sense, puts stronger assumptions than one is allowed to put if one just does unitarity, etc. And also, it doesn't give one main claim, a physical intuition of why whatever one is deriving is not just some abstract measure, but should be really construed as probabilities.
Sorry, which approach?
The Gleason
theorem.
Gleason theorem. Yeah,
okay.
Thank you. So, here is our task. Now, before we get to the task, let's revisit some history. So, Born's paper, and here is an English translation, it's called 5 pages long, is on quantum mechanics of consciousness, written 1 year after Schrödinger equation showed up. And the aim is to relate what happens in collisions of electrons with stuff to wave function and stuff. Right? Now, you read it, and there's an interesting footnote on page 1. This report was originally intended for Dina Kruki-Giesenschaften, but could not be accepted there for lack of space. Okay, so far so good. First interesting goodness. So we go on, and you know, it talks about things, and then page 2 or 3, the key result shows up. If one translates this result into terms of particles, only one interpretation is possible. Psi, and psi is the amplitude, it's the wave function, right? Gives the probability for the electron. Wait a second. Psi gives the probability? But that's not what textbooks say. But there is another footnote. Let's enlarge it. Addition and proof. More careful consideration shows that probability is proportional to the square of quantity psi.
I always wondered about something. Shouldn't he, isn't it the square of the absolute value?
Sorry?
Isn't he still wrong? Because shouldn't he get a square of the absolute value?
Look, you know, he got Nobel Prize 20 years ago. Don't ask these sorts of questions.
There was no space in there.
Yeah. So, now, clearly, this business of probability shows up roughly at the time where you're making or trying to make a transition from quantum to classical. So, at least my natural instinct would be to fall back on decoherence and use decoherence to explain it. And I mean, decoherence explains a lot. And I'll just give you a sort of lightning tour as a reminder what really needs to be explained and how it happens. Decoherence interaction between system and the environment, the important thing about it is not that you end up with mixed density matrix for the system. This we knew since at least von Neumann or Landau, I guess, because he was the first one to write down an object, which we now call reduced density matrix. The important thing is that when this happens, the states that end up on the diagonal of the reduced density matrix, if you fix the environment and look at sort of sensible situations, are always habitually the same. There's more places here, gentlemen. So, So, this fact that you have a preferred set of states means that you have they feel sort of broken the democracy, the egalitarian rule of the principle of superposition that you normally have. States are created equal in isolated systems. The moment you open the system, this equality between different states doesn't apply. Some states, the ones which will show up and see on the diagonal, apparently have a better survival probability, or whatever you want to call it, than the arbitrary superpositions. That's important. That's environment-induced super selection or mind selection. Now, in measurements, and this is a lightning tour, shouldn't stop you from stopping me or slowing me down, but I will go through it very quickly. In measurements, this means that you can convert quantum entanglement, which is formed between the system and the apparatus, and I'm using controlled knot-like notation here, you convert that entanglement into classical correlations. Okay? In dynamics, as a result of mind selection, states in the Hilbert space are censored, restricted to localized quantum approximations of quote-unquote points, but you still recover essentially classical equation of motion. How this happened? Well, in terms of Feynman representation, again, I think you know the story. If you have a Schrödinger cat-like superposition of something being here and there, then there is an interference term in between. Decoherence in this representation corresponds essentially to diffusion, maybe some sort of skewed diffusion, but diffusion nevertheless. And this diffusion takes out the interference term. This taking out of the interference term may depend on what the superposition is in. So for example, if you couple to the system through position, you will get rid of superpositions of position more quickly than superpositions of momenta. And you can look at it in terms of Figner function in phase space in dynamical systems. Here is, for example, a classical system evolving chaotically. It started as a Gaussian somewhere in the phase space. And here is a distribution of probability over the phase spaces in P, this is X. This map is sort of like geography. High peaks are red. So the low-lying deserts are yellow. Now, if you do the same thing quantum mechanically, you discover there is a big correspondence between this and this. You know, some of the big things happen, but you acquired colors which are different set of colors than before. Bigger functions dip below the sea level, again, like geography maps, high peaks red, below sea level blue. And this is a very quantum object. Particular, it has tiny structures in phase space. This square has surface area of one time constant, and there is structure clearly inside it. But when you have decoherence, and this is for comparison, the quantum and the classical, acting on this, you will conclude that the probability distribution ends up being very much like the classical one. You see that there is a little bit of quantumness in here because there is still two places where the Figner function dips below zero. Preferred states arise or are characterized by the fact that they are more robust and they do not get destroyed by the interaction with the environment. This is a sort of longish summary of a simple idea which seems to be working very well. Basically, you can look for preferred states by listing all of the states in the Hilbert space and then trying to find all the pure states in the Hilbert space and then trying to find out which pure states are preserved in spite of the fact that the system is immersed in the environment. And then it will turn out generally that there is a subset which do much, much, much better than a typical state in the Hilbert space. So this all works, and you could summarize it by saying, look, the thesis of this approach is that quantum theory can explain emergence of the classical, and the principle of superposition loses its validity in open systems, that is, systems interacting with the environment. States are no longer all equivalent. Decoherence restricts stable states. States that can persist and therefore exist with the exceptional point systems. they exist or evolve predictably in spite of their immersion of the system and the environment. Predictability serves as a sort of systematic way of looking for things which are predictable. It gives you these states on the platter, so to say, and environment-induced superselection is the main for this emergence of preferred stable states which survive interaction with the environment. Now, for macroscopic systems, it is known by now that decoherence line selection can be extremely effective. That is, survival of Schrodinger cat-like states is very much in danger, especially if the system is macroscopic and if the cat is big and sunsets. And so, ion selection enforces the effective border between quantum and classical. In some sense, one can recover the force approach, Copenhagen interpretation, without putting it. Now, that's all. By the way, there is a review paper in Reviews of Modern Physics 2 years ago. And I may even bring a couple of copies that I brought with me tomorrow, so if some of you have great urge to know more, there are 60 pages of Fredmont case that expound on the piece.
So it seems to me that at this stage you have a mechanism for assigning classical probabilities to different outcomes.
Yes.
You haven't told us how we get received single outcomes from things we might call measurements.
Well, I sort of implied. And let me tell you, let me get to it in a bit more detail. I haven't gone. Everett said the relative state, right? You are in some state, and therefore universe is in some state. Okay, I agree with this. What decoherence gives you is instead of having a sort of undefined relative state, which can be anything in the Hilbert space, since you are stable, and since things in a classical universe are predictable, it should be the state which are resistant to decoherence. So I think this defines how you split the overall wave function into branches. But the interpretation is very much in the relative state framework. By the way, I do not want to identify relative state with many walls. I think there is a big conceptual jump and sort of different connotations depending on whether you read Everett or others. So, great, so why don't we apply it? Right? We've got things to do. And that will give us classical law, some of Born's rule should be part of it. Well, the problem is, as I said before, reduced estimators depends on Born's rule. This stuff really is a big question if we want to derive Born's rule. So in a sense, you know, the key problem that we have in understanding everything, including the coherence approach, is how to understand Born's rule without putting it in an extraction. It just doesn't fit in an approach which doesn't want to collapse it. Okay, so we've started to where we've been 15 minutes ago. What are we doing? There is Giessen's theorem, but it's very much in the assumptions are very much in the framework of Copenhagen interpretation. It's hard to translate. So what are you going to do? Well, I will tell you about an approach which takes a very different tack on the problem. It's based on invariance. Now, invariance is aggregation from either environment or entanglement-assisted invariance. I've actually advocated both names. I was stuck on environment, although I've written both of them in papers. But then David Merrin actually last summer told me, look, once you say environment, people think about dynamics and something messy and so on and so forth. And this approach is actually much cleaner. There is no dynamics involved. So I take this point, and since I don't really have to change the abbreviation, I think this is going to be a better way of naming it. So what is invariance? It's a symmetry, but it's a funny sort of symmetry. What is a symmetry? Symmetry is a statement typically about an object or an operation. You do something and nothing happens. Right? You rotate the circle. You still have the same circle. This symmetry is what I would call an assisted symmetry. You do something here, the universe changes, but you can undo whatever you've done without touching whatever you've done things to. To be more specific, so suppose I have a system, a composite system, consisting of S and E, system and environment, could be Alice and Bob, could be whatever. Okay, two systems. When the combined system is transformed non-trivially by a unitary transformation, which acts really only on the S part of the whole, but can be untransformed, can be restored to whatever it was before by acting only on the E part of the whole, then I say that this state is invariant under US. Right? So I have two things. They're not interacting anymore, they're entangled. One of them is here, the other can be in the orbit of Saturn. I do something here. US is acting on this state. So this changes this psi into this phi. But then I can get back the original global state by acting on the other half. Now, this is funny, and it cannot happen classically to pure state. You know that. If you have a pure state of a classical system, composite system, that is a state about which you know everything about every piece of it. So a pure classical state is a Cartesian product of state of the pieces. So how come it happens in quantum mechanics? Well, it happens. And the reason it happens is because you have entangled states. So indeed, the key thing that we are going to investigate is entanglement. And so just to demonstrate simplest invariant transformation, let's write out a state in a Schmidt decomposition. Here it is. Now, lemma one. Every unitary transformation with Schmidt eigenstates, so this transformation is diagonal in this basis, is invariant. Why? Well, because that sort of transformation will just change phases of these coefficients. I can change phases of these coefficients equally well by acting on the E part of the whole. In other words, if I rotate phases by phi k, I can unrotate them by minus phi k by acting on the environment.
But aren't you assuming that both the environment and the system has the same set of states? I mean, in general, they have different label them. You were labeling them identically with this K. But usually the system has one enumeration of states and the environment has a different one. So you get all possible products.
This would be the case if I were to write things in a basis, one basis arbitrarily chosen for the system, the other basis arbitrarily chosen for the environment. Right? Now, it's a theorem of linear algebra, is that when you have a state like this, you can always rotate the basis of one and the basis of other, then instead of having the number of terms which is essentially equal to dimensionality of one system, time dimension of the second system, you're going to have the total number of terms equal to the smaller of the two dimensionalities. That's the Schmidt theorem, right? So these bases are not arbitrary. They are not necessarily unique, but for arbitrary coefficients, they are unique. Okay. So at this point, you all agree I can do it. There are finding systems, there are finding states for you. I can do something here and I'll do it somewhere there. Okay. Some properties. Invariant psi is an eigenstate of two unitary transformations with a unimodular eigenphi. It's just a state. Invariants can be defined for density matrices. But this is not really necessary. the philosophy that used here, and it can be applied fairly consistently, is known as church of larger Hilbert space. You probably know that. You can always unreduce a reduced density matrix by enlarging the Hilbert space. So you can always deal with pure space. I'm sweeping some things under the rug, but it's for the purpose of the lecture. Product of invariant transformations and invariant transformation, and all invariant transformations have Schmidt eigenstates. In fact, this last part I haven't proved, and I will let you accept. It's not going to play much of a role. So, fine. So we have these funny things. What do we do? How do we use them? Point one, which is very important, and we've sort of already got to that. A state, and there is, if you have an entangled pure state of this sort, then a state that describes S alone cannot depend on the phases of these coefficients. In a way, I've already proved it. But I think it's good to sort of back up a little bit and address simultaneously two issues, definition of two issues. One of them, what the heck do I mean by the state? And what the heck do I mean by the system? And instead of laboriously defining what's one and what's the other, I'm going to ask you to accept, or maybe argue, against or for the three facts, which combine or which use simultaneously state and the system in a way which I think defines them sufficiently for the purpose of what we are going to do. Fact number one, a unitary transformation must act on the system to alter its state. If it acts somewhere else, it's not going to do anything to the system. Fact two, the state of the system is all that is necessary, available, to predict measurement outcomes to these other probabilities. This really is a definition of the state. Fact three, a state of the composite system is all that is needed, available, to determine the state of the system. So if I have something bigger, then if I have a state for the bigger thing, this should allow me to have the state for the smaller. Any question or any objection at this stage? Please.
So in the context when the system environment are spatially separated, fact one is essentially an assumption of locality, that operations done
yes.
on E not influence the
yes.
state.
Yes. 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 Doesn't happen, right? Because spatial separation is, but yes. Anything else? Okay, so once you have these, you can convince yourself fairly easily, and I won't go through to the details of the proof, that the state of the system S, and therefore probabilities of whatever you want to measure on the system S, can depend only on the absolute values of these coefficients, not on their phases. Could be some funny function of the absolute values, which we don't know yet, but it cannot be phases. And the argument is basically that phases of this can be changed by acting somewhere else, phases of this decomposition. So in other words, by invariants, this set of pairs must provide a complete local description, here is the word we're looking for, of the system alone.
Question. So in fact, too, have you sneaked in the idea that actually there are probabilities at all? I mean, so you say the state of the system is all that's necessary to predict three probabilities. What about there are probabilities? So it seems like that's sneaking in the concept of probabilities.
Let me cross out the thing in brackets, okay? But I'm gonna stick to whatever can be measured is equivalent to the state, can be predicted as a state, right?
So if you do that, then theorem one would change?
Theorem one would not change. Because nothing in the state, I mean, the state is going to be independent.
The first word in theorem one is the word probabilities.
State of the system, okay, substitute, right? The whole thing would work through exactly, right? In fact, and I think that's a good point, the way it should be written is the way you're suggesting. Right? Because, not just because it looks like I'm sneaking something in, but because when you say state, you're saying something much more powerful than when you're getting probabilities. So there's a stronger theorem which is here.
Just following up on this, what do you predict about the measurement if you don't predict probabilities?
I can give you a glib, not completely glib answer, but correct, but glib answer, and we can come back to it. Right? I will assume I can work with situation where the probability of something is either 1 or 0. Okay? So certainty is certainly a sort of probability. But for instance, state of a statement about invariance is a statement about certainty. Right? If something has undergone a set of transformations, then I can remeasure it in such and such state and for sure expect this and this. Right? So certainty is, I'm going to sneak it, and I think it's sort of stuck in. That one's going to be stuck in.
So does that mean you'll be in effect working with ensembles when you come to...
No, no.
So you'll derive probabilities?
No, you can do ensembles, but I'm not going to work with... you can do ensembles, I'm not going to use it. They are done in the paper, sort of in the spirit, and we can talk about how it's going to happen later. So what am I going to do? So let me get to the essence. So we just proved that phases can be changed, and that the state of the system, and therefore probabilities, whatever they are, as long as they are defined by the state of the system, will not change. Okay? Now I'm gonna look at another and focus on the yellow part of transformations that I mean, another sort of transformation that I'm going to claim is invariant. Okay, I call it a swap. Now, I'm going to, so the swap is exactly sounds like this. I have a Schmidt decomposition. Notice that at this point I'm saying all of the absolute values of the coefficients are equal. Okay, so I'm focusing on what I call even states. And swap is swapping two things in this. Right, so before there was here a scale, now there's an SL paired up with EK, and vice versa. Why is swap invariant? Swap is invariant because I can undo it by counter swapping things in the environment. It's great suspicion. Therefore, let me go one transparency ahead and then come back. Okay? And this is sort of supposed to be a summary, but I'll do the summary as a primary. So the point is, symmetries can reflect ignorance. In fact, it's amazing how few books make that point. And I found it very, very satisfying that one of the first sentences in Asher Peres's book on symmetries, I mean, in his quantum makes this point. So I was very happy with him. But I agree with him on this as well. Now, this approach where symmetries are reflected in ignorance is actually the original approach to probabilities. That original approach to probabilities was founded by French aristocrats. They were playing cards and losing their castles and winning their castles. And gave a chance. So they needed smart people to help them work out strategies which would allow them to keep their castles and win a few more. Laplace was one of them. In fact, he is credited not so much with coming up, but with codifying. So it has to do with what you have, or what you are dealing with, when you have games of chance. Two cards. Right. Now, Laplace said, look, if you have two cards, and you have no idea what's on the other side, you may want to have some card to complete your hand, and you may know that one of them is, I don't know, a heart or a spade, only one of them. But because you don't know, you will be indifferent to when they are spotted. This is Laplace's principle of indifference. No ensembles, right? Symmetry. It's a funny sort of symmetry because it's a symmetry not of the cards, but of your state of mind, which is sort of uncomfortable for the business. It's not the symmetry of the cards, because on the other side, you know, the physical state changes when you swap. Okay? In classical physics, it must be like this. But in quantum mechanics, it doesn't. So, S are my cards, and E are the cards on another table on Saturn. I can swap these two cards, but it's not going to change the local physical state on my table. Why? Because I can counter-swap the cards on Saturn and recover the original state. So, in a sense, I am taking Laplace's idea, but not applying it to symmetries of the state of mind. I'm applying it to the symmetries of an entanglement state.
Well, I think now I backtrack.
I don't understand the fundamental thing that you keep on coming back to. As you say, when you have the linear combination up on that slide.
Yes.
And is it the one you just showed? Why you can't have the same environmental state multiplying the different system states? Why do you have to change the environmental state? Could you postulate that when you change the system state, that you must change the environmental state? Why is the system state and the environmental state matched? Because in order to make the construction that you just made, they must be matched. Along with 0s, it goes 1, it goes 0e, along with 0, 1s goes 1e. Why can't you have 0s and 1e?
You could have. It wouldn't make a difference. Right? All I'm saying is, then you would have a different global state. But the same sort of swaps that you can carry on this state where you say these indices are matched, you would be able to carry out on this other one. And the point is not so much that the indices are matched. The point is that the swap, which changes the global state by acting only on the S part of the whole, can be undone by acting on the other one.
And I say no matter what you do, it can always be undone.
No matter what you do, providing these coefficients are equal, it can always be undone. Right? Since I can restore the global state without acting anymore on the system.
You're asking us to check the output to see that.
It's really a level of high school, right? I mean, notation is beyond, but the algebra is. In fact, if I have enough time at the end, I'll show you this point in an algebra, which I think is going to be uncontestable.
May I ask a clarification question about the previous overhead, where you had symmetry can reflect ignorance? I understand what that means in the classical case. The symmetry of my probability assignment reflects my ignorance of what's on the other side of the cards.
Yes.
But in this case, I think you're going to claim that these probabilities are not merely subjective states.
Absolutely.
And so the question is, symmetry of the probability assignment reflects ignorance of what in the quantum case?
Ignorance of what's going to happen, right? At this point, you are sure of this global state. And because you are sure of this global state, you can prove to yourself, and you can even do experiments, which will show you that swapping things will not make any difference. Right? So it's not so much your ignorance which forces you to be ignorant. In some sense, this was the problem with Laplace's approach. It was circular. You sort of called likelihoods probabilities. Right? And both of them were sort of in the favorite in your mind. Here, your information about something global forces you to be ignorant about something local. So, good. So at this point, look, key result. If you have Schmidt decomposition of this sort with equal coefficients, which differ only by the phase, phases are irrelevant, we proved them before. Therefore, by normalization, each of these states has the same probability, 1 over n, where n is a total number of terms. No ensemble. Right? So here is a sort of unique experience I have. There's something there. I know what it is, but I want to know something else about it. And I can prove to myself that I can't know anything about this something else. And it's a property of the physical state. And I know it was captured by this previous discussion. It's not the property of my state of mind. It's objective in that sense. Okay, so now we've talked for 45 minutes, and I told you is that coefficients, when they are equal, imply equal probabilities. Oh, wait a second, they're going rather slow. Well, actually, it turns out that the next few steps, where you do it for unequal coefficients, are easy. So once you've set this up, the rest follows. So how does it follow? We went through this one, so I'm going to take it to you through it very, 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 very quickly. Okay. Special case with unequal coefficients. So I just have, so I have a system and the environment. System has just two states, 0 and 2. And the environment has at least three states, 0, 1, and 2. And this state is a superposition of 0 and 1. I'm just setting up the notation. Right? The entangled state written in a Schmidt decomposition, I've chosen judiciously and deliberately these special coefficients. This one is square root of 2, this one is square root of 1. Right? So there's a special ratio that I want. Now, I can't deal with a case of unequal coefficients. I can deal with a case of equal coefficients. So what I'm going to do is reduce the case of unequal coefficients to the case of equal coefficients. Standard check. How do I do it? I had an extra environment that is a very small prime here, e prime. Okay? And things are always going to be written in the order where the first thing is the system, the second thing is the original environment, and the last thing is the extra environment. So I get this state, the initial state of the extra environment is 0. This plus thing is 0 plus 1. And now I'm going to let this thing interact with the original environment, the extra environment interact with the original environment in such a way that it's sort of a generalization of controlled mode. In other words, k, 0 goes to k. Okay. That's a legal unitary transformation built up by the quantum population. So what happens if I do that? Well, I get this sort of a state, 0, 0, 0, right? This should be correlated, 1, 1, and 2, 2. Okay. Right? Now, the only non-trivial algebraic step in the calculation. Scratch up square root of 2 and square root of 2. You get a decomposition with equal coefficients. You can now indulge in invariantly swapping this pair, say with this pair, right? This can go with this, and counter swap that with that. Right? I have equal coefficients, so I can do all the things that I've done before. So in other words, if I were to ask about the probability of these three states, since they have equal coefficients, and since they exhaust all the possibilities, each of them has a probability of 1/3. Now there's actually two things, one of which is non-trivial and the other is trivial. The first one is that this probability must be 1/3, probability of stage 2. And that's obvious. This one would be easy if I were to say that these probabilities are additive. But it's actually not. I mean, additivity in quantum mechanics is something that you should be careful with. Gleason assumes it, for example. But it's better not to assume it. It's better to understand that it arises. And in this case, actually, it is approach. Oops, I don't want to go there. Yes. In this case, in this approach, it actually arises. Why does it arise? Because probability of 0 is equal to 1 minus probability of the rest. Turns out, this you can do and generalize. Right? So what I've done here, including this additivity discussion, can be done in general. And here is a busy transparency which does.
Sorry, can I ask a question on the previous transparency? When you said the environment is three states, 0, 1, and 2,
yes.
You've taken the combination plus.
Yes.
But there is another independent linear combination minus.
I could have gone with a minus.
No, I understand, but why don't you keep all three? I mean, it looks to me as though you're losing one. You don't lose probability, but you lost one linearly independent state for the environment.
No, I didn't. I mean, let me. I think this is more trivial than you think it is.
Let me see if there's somewhere where I can. Right, we don't need to do it.
All I'm saying is I have, a state which is proportional to square root of 2, 0, something correlated with 0 in the environment, and whatever that is, I don't care. Right?
Yes, but why is it unique? Why is epsilon 0, you postulate.
No,
there's a correlation between the system and the environment. So you have three environment states and two system states.
Yes.
Why don't you have the complete tensor product? Why have you restricted yourself?
As I said before, and I think we have. Yeah.
And that's what we're struggling to understand.
This is a substance and the essence of the Schmidt theorem. Right? So, and the Schmidt theorem says, if you have a pure entangled state, you can always write it in such a way that there is an orthonormal set of basis states.
So we want to know the definition of a pure entangled state. Is this a definition that you can write it this way?
Any state psi S E such that if you construct a projection operator of it, right? Sorry, I'm doing a silly thing. What I really want to do is trace rho S in squared. If this is one, that's a pure state, right? It's going to be an entangled state if there is more than one term in the expansion.
Pure things.
Right? So,
that's good.
Sure.
Would it be fair to characterize this proof as just reducing the question of why the probabilities obey the L2 norm to the question of sort of why the unitary swap operations preserve the L2 norm as opposed to some other norm?
I suppose so, right? So in other words, what I'm saying is I am assuming Hilbert space, right? Which means I'm assuming a lot.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And now, given that I've assumed Hilbert space, I want to give you an intuitive proof of why things are equal You know, in certain cases.
Right.
Yes.
Right, but I mean, you can kind of see here, like, with the square root of 2/3. Once you've got the calcium preserved, then the rest kind of flows out.
No, I'm assuming, I am assuming axioms are black axioms in quantum mechanics.
So I wanted to come back to the beginning. If the universe is a pure entangled state, and we separate it into two pieces, the S and E, and then you say that that's a typical example of what you have.
I would like to leave the questions which contain the word universe in them until after. I think, you know, I should finish within 5 minutes or so to be fair to the. So the point is, I can do it whenever. I can do the same sorts of tricks with a bit more of algebra whenever I have coefficients here, squares of which are commensurate, right? Make this sum into sum of many more terms which have equal coefficients, and then count the number of the coefficients, and after I'm done with it, I get one rule. Now, half of the audience is happy at this point, usually. Half of the audience says, what if these things are not commensurate? Right now, take me seriously, right? I'm prepared. So, I mean, first question is, first answer is what you demonstrated. Right? I mean, give me the case where you'd be able to measure non-commensurate probabilities. The second one is, you know, you can go into Dedekind cuts, etc. But the point is, if you want to go through it, you assume continuity. I think this is interesting, right? Because if you do Gleason's theorem, you don't have to assume continuity. You assume additivity, and you get continuity. Mm-hmm. Here, you assume continuity, but you get additivity. And I think in quantum mechanics, I'd rather get additivity, because additivity in quantum mechanics is really the thing that's sort of in question.
What is the assumption of continuity?
Oh, because, you know, if I want to start with coefficients which cannot be expressed all, you know, in this form.
Right? No, but what do you mean by assuming continuity?
Well, I have to say that you know, I have, Dedekind cut. I don't know if you're familiar with Dedekind.
The assumption really is that the probabilities, whatever they are continuous functions.
The state. Yes.
And continuous in the L2 norm.
Yes.
Same
comment. Thank you. If the audience is ahead of the speaker, they must have done a good job so far in the lecture. Okay, so a summary. New symmetry invariants. Now it's very quantum symmetry. Right? You don't have a structure here. And the fact that it exists in quantum mechanics is this Cartesian versus Spencer issue of how you represent states. Now, two, and I think this is really the gist of it. In quantum physics, perfect knowledge of the whole may imply complete ignorance of the part. Right? In classical physics, this cannot happen. In quantum mechanics, you can make this a foundation of the whole approach. So if there is, you know, any of these points that I would underline, this is number two. And three, I mean, you've seen it, Born-Schrödinger is a consequence of invariance. You can deal with relative frequency interpretation and sort of frequency approach, et cetera, on this basis. It's in my papers. I don't want to do it. It's sort of, there's plenty of involved notation, and I'd be happy to talk about it. But it doesn't, the gist of the story is you already know. And in some sense, you know, since I've kind of started by undermining the whole foundation of decoherence, environment, superselection, etc., by saying, look, we can't do it really consistently if we don't know how probabilities arise, I would claim that invariance supplies a new foundation for all of that. And in fact, it's interesting, and there's this longish paper that I published in PRA a few months ago, where you can get preferred bases without doing trace operation, just by appealing to invariants like arguments. Now, there was someone who wanted me to simplify notation somewhat. Let me see if I can do it for him. So here's the whole talk in a very simplified notation. Laplace's version of symmetry, like argument, derivation of probabilities. And by the way, this was the way to do probabilities until, I don't know, 1850s, 1870s. I think in some sense, this is the way you do it whenever you're doing things which are Bayesian. You are saying that your subjective ignorance is somehow, you know, important. Okay? Now, it's very clear that in many situations, you know, at a card table, etc., this is what you actually do. But it's also very clear that in physics is not very satisfying because you would like to have these properties attached to actual states. And the problem with that is that if you were to look at the same situation from below the table, you would see an actual change of the state. However, and here is the algebra, if you are dealing with quantum states, then you start here, a swap gets you here, but now you swap in the environment, and it gets you back to where you started. Now,
so are we not supposed to look at the middle line there?
You're supposed to look at the whole thing, it's so legal.
So even the middle.
Sorry?
I know what's happening.
No. You should look at the middle line. Right? I mean, this is in fact very important, right? If I were to do a verification of this stuff, I would want to know that invariance is a symmetry. Indeed. Right? So one experiment I would propose, and people haven't done it, right? And they've done marvelous things with entangled systems, but they haven't done this one. And the more sophisticated version, which should be also done, is that with certainty, probability one, and this is where I introduce, this is where probability comes in, right? But it's a probability of one. I get from here to here. Right? So if I started here and then I do this, and it's a unitary operation, but I can do it. And if I measure the global state, it's gonna be here. Right? So you can look at the whole thing, right? It's a physical thing and it changes. It's just that the fact that this state is different from this state, but that this initial state can be restored without acting on what you messed around to begin with, is that this is the basis for probability approach, right? I mean, in other words, I don't know if you've seen it, that if you go to county fairs, etc., there are people who have three cups, right, and a marble or something under one of them, and they do this. Right, and you know, at this point, you know, if you are in this world, you are sort of in Laplace's shoes, right? Because you don't know, but I mean, that thing is the marble under one of the cups. This is a rigorous proof that in quantum mechanics, you could place this sort of game in a way, you know, where the marble actually will not be under any of the cups.
At some point you mentioned that this is related to cosmology.
Well, I think, you know, the point was made by I think Lucien, right? I mean, the fact that you call things systems, you know, if you want to associate systemness, whatever, with the fact that they are separate, which is nice. Then these two are related. I think locality is in some sense probably a stronger assumption than was necessary, right? Because you can.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Yeah.
Locality, you mean
yeah.
just that I can't
understand a signal. Yeah. By the way, three things I should say, because I had my note, but they are still in my office, so I won't run for them. But I know some of them that I wanted to say. I mean, first of them, you might object. Look, I'm not interested in probabilities for entangled states. I'm interested in probability of the state that has a wave function given by some psi alone. What do I do there? Well, I'm telling you, you have no choice. You're going to entangle things. How are you going to entangle things? The moment you start measuring it, it's going to get entangled to begin with the apparatus, and at this point, it's going to apply, and actually, it's going to get entangled with the environment. Right? So all of this clearly goes beyond. The other two that I wanted to mention, one of them was actually brought up already. And you know, you can, it's interesting to go through, and I've given the hour I want, and look at this whole thing simultaneously, you know, from the point of view of this sort of global state and how it transforms, and from the point of what happens if you are one of these things. Right? And this gives you a new appreciation for what collapse means. Right? How can you think about things having been collapsed in a universe which is evolving according to the some sort of Everettian, like you would say. And the third thing that I was supposed to say, I really forgot, so let me leave it here.
Understand the status of your proof. I'm worried that you still snuck in the concept of probability. So let me argue about this. Let's read your proof. Show to take that you prove that if there's something called probability, okay, then probability has to satisfy this property. This property is equal to the one squared.
Okay.
But from what you haven't done is show probability is the same as the thing probability when you understand it to be ineligible. In other words, that it has some relationship with experiments that we're doing in the laboratory.
I'm not completely sure whether I understood your question, but let me start answering and then you'll tell me. Right? See, what I've shown, and I think what does have connection with what happens in the laboratory, is that in situations where swap operations operate on a known set, they swap it, then the outcomes are predictable of these swaps. Right? Now, in a situation where you have entanglement and you have equal coefficients, then the outcomes are such that they guarantee that whatever you do with these swaps hasn't changed the state. Now, this means that whatever property you get out of this is going to, I mean, the state of the system is unchanged, right? So now I'm falling back on Laplace's argument,
yeah.
Right? There are three alternative options, of which I'm going to correlate, I'm going to perceive one. And here I can do it a la Copenhagen, I can do it a la Everett. So I'm sitting here stretching my head, the unmeasured state of the system is here, I can do all of these transformations on it before I actually try to find out what the outcome is. Okay? So I know that there are five or three or whatever alternative things I can swap. And they don't change, that swapping doesn't change anything locally. Right? So, I mean, this is a proof by the guy who has three cups and a marble under one of them. Right? I mean, that's a physical connection. Now, whether this implies that probability is probability, I think, is another concept which I think is very appropriate in pubs. I like it.
One would say that what you've shown is that the concept of probability, as announced by Laplace, you recover with your and the variance argument.
I would disagree. I would agree and disagree.
Disagree with that.
I would agree and disagree. The reason I agree is that I very much do it in the spirit of relating probability to symmetry.
Right.
I disagree because Laplace had to fall back on the symmetry of something which was
Laplace.
Ill-defined state of mind.
Right.
I do it on a physical state of this system.
Right.
So I think, you know, in that sense, you know, quantum mechanics really offers an insight into probabilities that classical physics couldn't, and the reason it couldn't, you know, because Cartesian state didn't admit the same structure composite systems as quantum mechanics.
Yes, but to come back, you still haven't shown that the sums of the squares of all of these things is one.
That's
shoving.
No. It started with normal. I would let the audience fight it out, but there's more questions.
How about the probabilistic nature of predictions in time in quantum mechanics? Let's say you have radioactive decay. You don't know when the atom is going to decay. It's probabilistic. You can calculate that. Can you give an interpretation of it?
Yeah. No, I mean, I won't do it now. Basically, the main thing that you need to do is you need to take this argument, which was for countable things, to things which are continuous. This can be done. Right? Now, you probably...
Why does it help?
Sorry?
Why does that help for the temporal?
Because I can translate, usually, things that are temporal into things that are spatial or that have... Right? I mean, I can have a system which acts as a clock, and a system which acts as, right? So I can have a detector with a clock, right? And then I can do the whole, you know, Schmidt decomposition, et cetera, et cetera. And there's no problem. Right? I mean, I'd be happy to explain in detail, but there is no problem. Basically, I'm gonna have a set of EK states where K is equivalent to time, okay?
Yes. Does any of this help you understand better Bell's puzzle in the, you know, in the form, say, that Mermaid describes it?
I don't think there's a puzzle there, right? I
mean, well, there is a puzzle.
I'm going to give you a good answer, right? I mean, yeah. I think in some sense, you know, it's not so much that it helps me understand. I build the whole foundation of this approach. I'm saying that the other, let me be as blunt and controversial as I possibly can, right? The foundation of this approach, or the approach here, is to explain things taking entanglement as whatever it's called, extranundum, the things that I want to use to explain other things, yeah. Not as something I need to explain.
I see. Okay, well then there is no problem with that.
But I mean, really, I think there's more. Okay, there is more. there was some question in the back.
I'm asking whether you couldn't, in fact, realize something like this classically.
So all of the things about locality go to hell.
No, because you translate yeah. The subsystem and you translate absolutely. The environment and you get
absolutely.
Back to the same state.
Absolutely. So. Well, very good. So actually, right, I mean, there is a thing known as Newton's bucket. You know that. Right, I mean, Newton's idea that you have a bucket in which water is spinning and there's meniscus. And his idea is that you can make the meniscus even by spinning the rest of the universe as a coronal. So the property that I'm using here is not so much, you know, tensor structure, I suspect.
That's not.
But I think that's called Newton's bucket.
Yeah.
Experiment is
Newton's, but it was Mach that Newton would say that everything is rotating, then you have that, and Mach said,
okay. Thank you for straightening up. But I mean, the point is that in quantum mechanics, you can have situations where systems know about each other so intimately that they can't know about anything else. And this is what I'm using. And I think even in a theory where you have that property, right? So, you know, there's two objects in the universe. You boost one of them. So then there's a different state. You can boost the other one that moves at the same velocity. Then you are back in the same spot, right? So in some sense, that's a sort of primordial property that one is using here.
Yeah, but there's a difference between global symmetry and the same. So your environment is more like gauge symmetry. So suppose I'm thinking that a diffeomorphism environment. Your system is a scalar field. The environment is the metric. Then you have true. You know, if you have a gauge symmetry, then you have this type of behavior in classical systems. Gauge symmetry is more or less this thing.
I don't know what it is, right? I mean, I know what you are saying, and I thought about it. And I very much wanted to find a symmetry in physics, it is gauge symmetry in the sense that you are doing something to something else. right? But I think gauge symmetry, there are differences, and one of the differences is in some sense there isn't gauge symmetry, is a gauge symmetry, because you never ask questions over phase, ultimately, okay? And the point is here, is that phase is the only thing that matters, right? So I agree with what you are saying, but I don't think I'm agreeing with it, or I haven't been able to make this agreement useful in the past.
That was also my question. So could you use this to derive probability statements in classical physics, and would they be correct? I don't quite see how it would go, but the possibility of the analogy seems to be there.
Possibility of the analogy seems to be there, but the states in classical physics are absolute.
Rotation is maybe controversial, but translation, I think, is not controversial.
I think it's an interesting argument to pursue. I haven't succeeded in taking it beyond where I took it. I think it's a tensor product structure, which is important, and that you generally don't have. But I suspect that one can fall back on this sort of less strong property of, I don't know, ultimate intimacy between two systems, which comes from entanglement, which is the entanglement. Lucien, last one? No?
Just a comment. There's something curious about this. One attempt at interpreting quantum theory is class models. And class models introduce probabilities, as the probability of that collapse happening.
Yes.
Whereas here, curiously, if you had a class model, actually you would lose the ability to set yes. your derivation. It would depend crucially on there being no collapse in order to get probabilities, which is quite curious.
It's curious, but it's not completely, if you look at this whole thing from the point of view of a single branch, which is what I was sort of encouraging before, you recover that, right? I mean, the point is that if you are in a single branch, you just get one piece of this, right? And there's nothing to be invariant about in this one piece, right? Basically the point is that this is already a Cartesian product. Yeah.
What if you had a system and the rest of the universe is small compared to the system, would it be more classical than quantum then? Because it wouldn't have enough to be entangled with, so to speak.
Well, I mean, the funny thing is that in some sense entanglement doesn't necessarily... I mean, because of the Schmidt decomposition, entanglement is a great polarizer. Right? You can have a spin 1/2 entangled with a field which has 10 to 23 degrees of freedom.
Yeah, but
the Schmidt decomposition will still hold.
No, that's right, but as you pointed out before, you get the smaller of the two dimensions.
Yes.
Right, and so if your system is enormous, but you have available in the rest of the universe just a few dimensions, then...
So you're going in the opposite direction.
Yes.
But then you have to describe. Then you have no tools to describe non-classicality because all your possible answers should be collapsed combined in very few degrees of freedom, for then it will be classical.
Yeah, so you would basically get, for lack of possibility to entangle, you would get effective classicality or something like that?
Well, I have a feeling that there should be a symmetry between when one of these things is large and the other is small, whichever of them is large. Right, so I somehow worry that on closer examination, this argument may not be as watertight as you might like it to be, but it's an interesting thought.
If you have a large quantum system, there's no preferred tensorial decomposition of the Hilbert space, I mean, from the mathematical point of view.
Yeah, a single system.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we've already touched on a couple of times a sort of vague question of what is a system. And I'm inclined to think that it's actually up to us. It's kind of a subjective or conventional thing, what we decide to call one system and what we decide to call another system. We could have tensorially decomposed the Hilbert space in a different way. And if you do that, and then run your sort of argument or procedure, you'll get another bunch of probabilities for some different looking things. Would you regard those as somehow equally valid or equally meaningful, or is there, does there need to be a preferred density composition for the universe for this approach to work?
No, I think it would work with any decomposition, but I think I would not agree with your statements that it's sort of up to us to decompose this. Because I think Hamiltonians, you know, the way they behave, they single out, or they make these very strong preferences of what can be a system or what can be a system. Right, so I don't think I'm comfortable with a very subjective business of you know, what is a system, what is not. Now, it's true that in all of this derivation, I've never once had a Hamiltonian. Right? So this approach to probability goes for whatever two subspaces of the Hilbert space. But I don't know whether, you know, you would really call a system in the sense that it sort of obliges the system to behave like any arbitrary piece of analytical Hilbert space. I think it's the Hamiltonians which have decided. And it's Raphael's question from earlier on. That, yeah, it'll be the first question of the talk. Do you want to comment on it?
I wanted to raise a question which is certainly related, but maybe Rob can give his question first.
Sorry. It's a completely different question, actually. so maybe you should.
Okay. Well, it goes back to another question, which maybe the second question, which was Eric's question. I didn't understand the answer. Maybe that's because I don't understand what you call the relative state interpretation. But I mean, you have this pure state of the conveyance system. You have the Schmidt decomposition. And then somehow you're telling us something, but I can't quite get what it is. It may be that only one of those components of the Schmidt decomposition is real, or maybe they're all real. That sounds like many worlds. So my question is just, please repeat your answer to Eric's question in more detail, but also with respect to another issue, which is, in which frame are we supposed to do this, right? Because we know that a lot of the paradoxes, that is Lorentz frame, we know that a lot of the paradoxes, quantum mechanics interpretations, come from considering things that are not simultaneous in different ways. I mean, like in Lucian's versions of the Bell inequality, for example. So that's when you're going to jump. If you stick in one frame of reference, then you can say that at any given time there's a well-defined decomposition, and maybe that's the reality. But if you try to make those compatible among different reference frames, then you can get into logical contradictions.
It's a long question.
Yeah. It's two questions.
Yeah. So let me answer them very briefly. Right? On the first one, let me repeat it. Is the whole wave function of the universe real, or is one of the branches real? Okay, my answer is I don't know. Right? And the nice thing about this is that all of the questions that I can that I get to ask and answer can be posed without taking sides. And the extent to which I think quantum mechanics refuses to take sides in this question. I'm not saying quantum mechanics, they take sides very well, but quantum mechanics is interesting. It tells me something, right? And I think what it tells me is, and there are two philosophical words attached to it, right? One of them is ontic, meaning things are a certain way, and the other is epistemic. We know about things as being certain. And I have a feeling that quantum mechanics doesn't distinguish. Now, it's a cop-out in a sense, but I think it's not a trivial cop-out. I think really quantum mechanics is trying to tell us that it doesn't like to distinguish between two different functions of classical states. Right? It would be interesting, I don't want to do it because it would take too much time, to go through the three facts that I listed before and apply them to two different meanings of a state when they talk about classical physics. One meaning is, you know, there is an absolute state of the system. Because the system is classical, I could find out what the state
walls before anybody started measuring them, right? Every observer who would do things right would agree on what the state was. These states are objective and real. That's one meaning of the state, the real state of the system. And that's the one kind of existence. The other meaning of the word state is actually very much epistemic. Patch in a phase space. In classical physics, it's supposed to be true that this shadow state of what I know doesn't really matter. What's supposed to matter is only this objective state. That's physics. The rest of it is philosophy, whatever other invective one wants to use in this context. But the point is that at some point classical physics says, now wait a second, you start doing Maxwell's demons of thermodynamics, this separation of, I don't know, church and state, spirituality and the real stuff doesn't hold. Right? And quantum mechanics says it, you know, much more bluntly. Right? So I think that there is a message there. And while answering the message of your first question, I forgot the second one. You want to remind me or
can I say? No. Then you might get into problems if you did this decomposition. I mean, your present point of view, you don't even need decoherence or anything like that.
No.
I could take a simple system like two entangled silver atoms or something like that.
Yeah.
And I could do this decomposition at different frames of reference.
Oh, I see.
With simultaneous measurements or potential measurements, simultaneous in different frames. And then I'll get into these kind of paradoxes.
I don't know what to say to it. I mean,
I give reality to each of the branches, let's say. I think you can get into a lot of frustration.
I don't know what you can. I mean, it would be interesting to pursue. Like, I, you know, Rob, sorry.
I'm wondering if the main ingredient of your proof can be thought of as an assumption of non-contextuality. So and in that sense, it would be similar to Gleason-like proof. So the Gleason-like proof says that if I have a three-dimensional Hilbert space, I measure this ray versus this subspace. So it doesn't matter whether I measure this tripod and then coarse grain these two outcomes, or whether I measure this tripod and coarse grain these two outcomes. The way I decompose the 2D subspace to 1D subspace is irrelevant to the probability. That's the assumption of Gleason's theorem. And what strikes me as similar in your derivation is when you say, well, I don't know, but perhaps you could say, you know, the probability doesn't depend on whether I first done a unitary on the system and then a unitary on the environment to undo it, or whether I did neither of them, that the probabilities will not change in those two cases. So those are different procedures I do in the lab. Either I do nothing or I do this pair of unitaries. And what you're saying is that the probabilities don't depend on that distinction of what's done in the lab, because that distinction doesn't have a representation in the formula.
I mean, I see parallels, but I mean, as you sort of hesitated at some point whether this parallels are good, I also saw the hesitation. I mean, I would also hesitate to say yes, right? I mean, I think, yes, you are looking at invariants, so then whenever you say invariants, you can probably tie to different sorts of invariants, right? And non-contextuality is an invariant. But I mean, this is a very specific, and I think Gleason was also quite specific. I don't see that they are really this close.
Yeah, I understand. Would you like to just, so when they're juggling around a bit, if anyone wants to leave, but they there is no shame.
It's at this point.
This is the official end of the talk. Anyone wants to carry on, someone say that.
Yes. I guess I have a comment on Luton's comment or several questions back, but for that, I think you gave in too easily, and I think your theory is stronger than what you were letting on to be. I think it applies in a collapse context also.
The proof.
Yeah, because as long as my collapse theory, whatever it is, obeys no signaling, then it has to be the case that whatever I do over here doesn't change the probabilities over there, so the probabilities are going to be
you are right, you're absolutely right. In fact, there is a nice paper by Howard Arnold posted like 2 years ago, basically making this one. So, yeah, you're right. I mean, the reason it's unsatisfying to me personally is that I want a single theory to run the whole universe, at least as much of it as possible.
Yeah.
And if I, you know, say, oh, Copenhagen, too early, I think I sort of. So the reason I gave them to Lucien is because I don't want to give them to this other figure.
If I try to sound pedantic, I like derivation, but let's play it was a common lack of equation. What if we have non-commensurate coefficients? But let's say, how do we know if we have equal coefficients before we have measurement theory? Before we measure something, let's have probability rule or anything. How do we know that our original entangled state has equal?
So isn't it
like, did it sneak to some sort of measurement theory or Born's approach or anything before?
No, I don't think so. The reason I don't think so is that I'm posing a question in a very specific context. And I think we have three talks going on in parallel at this stage. So I think it's going on. But I mean, the point is that at the very beginning, you know the state. So the situation is you first measure something.
Yeah, right?
You have a psi with 100% probability, right? Because you've measured it, right? Now, doesn't come out, doesn't matter what rule applied until you come out and got to the result. But from then on, when you measure psi, you're going to get a psi.
Yeah.
And this is the only treatment, right? So I don't think I need anything more. Because once I know the psi.
You need a special form to build your proof. You need a special form of psi. And that requires more than just confirmation. You need a psi to be able to equal the efficiency in your basis.
No, I need a psi which is 100% in substance. And then I get a correlation. I think the audience is losing focus, so I
think.